Welcome to the inaugural Agricultural and Applied Economics Association Extension Section webinar, intended to assist agricultural professionals meet the challenges in today's agriculture. Today's webinar is entitled Inflated Expectations, Unfulfilled Mandates, and Cost-Efficient Feedstock Systems for Cellulosic Biofuels. What's a Farmer to Do? This webinar is being brought to you by the AAEA Extension Section with the able assistance of the Western Extension Committee using technology provided by Montana State University. We'd like to pause and acknowledge the contribution of the Western Extension Committee's program Ag in Uncertain Times, an award-winning series of over 50 webinar presentations, recordings, and supporting web-based materials. The Ag in Uncertain Times team is providing the support and technology behind today's webinar, without which these presentations would be much more difficult, if not impossible, to deliver. Additional information on Ag in Uncertain Times may be found on the web at farmmanagement.org. I'm John Hewlett, Ranch and Farm Management Specialist at the University of Wyoming and Western Region Representative to the Extension Section. And it is indeed an honor to serve as today's host for the webinar. With the help of today's speakers, we'll take a closer look at the economics of biofuels here in the U.S. Today's presenters include Dr. Francis Eplin, a Charles A. Breedlove Professor of Agricultural Economics at Oklahoma State University, and Dr. Cole Gustafson, a professor and biofuels economist in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at North Dakota State University. We'll provide a much more in-depth introduction for each of our presenters as we transition to their formal presentations, but just to give you a little insight as to how we expect the webinar to proceed this morning, we'll begin with a few brief comments and explanation of the technology, followed by a few polling questions before beginning today's presentations. We'll then proceed with our two formal presentations with time for a couple of brief questions after each presentation. And finally, if time permits, we'll have a more general Q&A session following those formal presentations. We have a chat pod where we can take input from the audience for our presenters. Please type your questions in there at the lower right-hand corner of the screen and provide questions that you might like to have our presenters address, or if you have technical problems with any of your connections, computers are a wonderful mechanism, certainly can help us overcome distances and solve problems, and including making webinars like this a reality. However, it does seem like the same technology can also create headaches for all of us at different times, so if you're experiencing difficulties, we certainly encourage you to contact our team to get those resolved as needed. The extension section is just one of over 15 sections of the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association. These sections are subgroups formed by AAEA members with common interests. The AAEA sections are intended to promote networking through a variety of different activities, including pre- and post-conference workshops and track sessions at the annual meeting, email discussion listservs, as well as other unique programs such as today's webinar. If you are not a member of AAEA or the Extension Section, we'd like to invite you to join by following one of the URLs on the screen. As we go along today, if you're having trouble reading the screen at any point, you may want to try using the full screen button at the upper right-hand corner of the screen. That button actually switches between the view that you see now and a view where the presenter slides cover the entire screen, making smaller text easier to read. Please note that while you are in that full screen mode, you'll be unable to see the chat window. All you do is just simply press the button again to reveal the chat window and enter any questions that you might have for our presenter team. We have a couple of brief questions here solicit from the audience your input on a couple of points as we launch in today's webinar. The first is, what region of the U.S. is it that you're joining us from, whether it be the Northeast, Northwest, South, etc., or if you're from outside of the U.S., we have an international choice there that you can make that selection. I appreciate your input on that. It helps us to kind of better understand who all it is that's participating. Our next question is, what affiliations are that are on the screen might apply to you and your situation? We're aware that the membership of AIEA and the Extension Section is a fairly diverse group with varied interests, and answers to this question can help. We are hoping to focus our efforts into the future, as well as perhaps select topics for presentation and whatnot for future webinars or track sessions. So, again, appreciate your completing that, and please make sure you check all that apply. It's possible to select one or more of those that might apply to your situation. Our third question, just a couple of shorter ones here at the end. I'd like to know whether or not you're thinking we might consider or should consider additional webinar topics as sponsored by the Extension Section. Your thoughts as to whether yes or no. I might point out that as we go along today, if you have thoughts about other webinar topics, we'd invite you to provide those to us via that chat window, as well as any other insights that you might have about offerings of the section. And finally, our final question here is, do you currently conduct extension or outreach programs in the biofuels area in your own extension programming or outreach work? Yes or no? Appreciate your insights there, trying to get a handle on just how many people are actually working in this area. A lot of interest in it around the country as you talk with people, so again, thank you for those comments. We'll now move on to our first presenter, who is Dr. Francis Eplin. I'll provide just a little insight here about Dr. Eplin's work. Now, his research focuses on the economics of agricultural production and resource use. He's involved in conducting economic analysis of alternative crops and livestock production systems, including the expected economics of dedicated energy crops. His work includes development of comprehensive field-to-biofuels models designed to identify key cost components, potential bottlenecks, and reveal opportunities for reducing costs and prioritizing research. These models have been used to determine for a specific region the most economical sources of biomass, optimal number of harvest machines, timing of harvest and storage, biorefinery size, biorefinery location, and conversion systems. In addition, these models can be used to determine the biofuel price required for an economically viable cellulosic biofuel system with the ultimate goal of developing a profitable business model. Dr. Eplin joins us for today's inaugural AAEA Extension Section webinar to present Inflated Expectations, Unfulfilled Mandates, and Cost-Efficient Feedstock Systems for Cellulosic Biofuels. Dr. Eplin, we'll turn it to you now and look forward to your comments.
Well, thank you very much, John, and good morning, good day, and good afternoon to everyone out in webinar land. In our first section, we're going to talk about a number of issues, and then later Cole will follow up and talk about some very specific things. The issues that I have outlined are a little bit about energy, corn ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, drop-in fuels, and then my comment regarding what is a farmer to do. In 2010, the United States used an average of 19.1 million barrels per day of crude oil. That is a substantial amount of fuel, and it accounts for about 38% of our total U.S. energy use, with about 24% from natural gas, 22% from coal, 8% from nuclear, and then 8% from the renewable energy, where renewable includes hydroelectric, geothermal, wind, solar, and biomass. Today is the first anniversary of the British Petroleum Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The well spilled oil into the Gulf for 87 days, and the engineers estimated that over that time period, a total of 4.9 million barrels was leaked. That is equivalent to 6 hours of U.S. use. transportation during wartime. And the promise of cellulosic ethanol was that it was seen as a means to convert waste materials to fuel. And one of the big early proponents of cellulosic ethanol proposed that it would be a way to take municipal solid waste that people were paying a tipping fee to dispose of and convert that into a valuable product. So some of the early proponents projected the feedstock cost to be very close to zero. A frequently cited article in Science magazine published in the year 1991 included the hypothesis that by the year 2000, with continued development, technology could be developed enabling the production of cellulosic ethanol for 60 cents per gallon. Now that would be $1.22 in 2010 dollars, and that would be about $1.82 per gallon of gasoline equivalent. So with all of this optimism, in 2007, Congress passed and President Bush signed the U.S. Energy Independence and Security Act, which includes the renewable fuel standards that provides the mandates for the use of biofuels. Now, these mandates are conditional on production, in that material has to be produced before we can mandate the use. So why did we include the mandates in the 2007 Act? Well, the experts proclaimed and really were optimistic that it was doable. It was a means to ensure a market by requiring the existing system to use the biofuels, and a guaranteed market was expected to facilitate investment in biorefineries. The RFS2 mandates include mandates for conventional biofuels. That's the bottom, the orange part of the chart on the bottom, and that's limited to 15 billion gallons. Most of that would be for corn ethanol. The discussion today is mostly about the blue area up here, and by the year 2022, the mandates for 16 billion gallons of this cellulosic biofuel. The original mandates for 2010 and 11 were for 100 and 250 million gallons. But since the material was not available at that level in 2010, the EPA reduced the mandate to 6.5 million gallons, and the mandate for this year has been reduced to 6.6 million gallons. So as the chart shows, we did not meet our goals. So what happened? Well, primarily, I think the message is that the conversion cost targets were not achieved. Another issue is that there are a number of competing technologies, and the best of the competing technologies remains to be determined, and people are reluctant to invest in the wrong technology. So a group of industrial engineers released a study last year in which they evaluate eight different alternatives for producing ethanol from biomass, and they determined that the lowest cost production system produced ethanol at $5.13 per gallon of gasoline equivalent. So we can conclude that one problem is that it has been more costly to produce than anticipated. Another problem has to do with what is known as the blend wall. Prior to October of 2010, blends for non-flex fuel vehicles were limited to 10%. So we had the E10 blends. And in 2010, we used 138.5 billion gallons of gasoline in blends that contained about 13.2 billion gallons of ethanol. So when the blends were limited to 10%, the mandate residue, sugarcane bagasse, and then, of course, crop residues, corn stover, wheat straw, and our dedicated energy crops, switchgrass, miscanthus, energy sorghum, and energy cane. Now, if technology can use any of the feedstocks, we would expect entrepreneurs to locate plants near what they consider to be an inexpensive source, and the least cost source is likely to be used first. Now, a typical plant, if we wanted to produce 50 million gallons of biofuels per year, may require up to 2,000 tons per day of biomass. So if we operated 350 days per year, 700,000 tons of biomass per year would be required, and that would take about 5 trucks per hour, 24 hours per day, 7 days a week. Now, for larger plants, if we had a if we had 100 million gallons per year of biofuel, we might have be able to produce the 16 billion gallons from 150 plants. So if we had 150 to 300 biorefineries that would require from 2 to 4,000 tons per day, these plants would require a truck to unload 5 or 10 trucks every hour, 24 hours a day. So there's a potential large market for our agricultural residues and also for dedicated energy crops. Last year, the EPA put together a set of projections of where the cellulosic biorefineries might be located, and these were projections based on the best guesses that they had. Most of the way they started is by locating the source of the feedstock, and of course the major feedstocks we have over here, the green triangle is from municipal solid waste plants, and those, of course, would be located near major cities, Chicago and Philadelphia, New York, and Dallas and Denver. And then the bagasse plants would be located where we have the sugar cane in South Texas and Louisiana and South Florida. The ag residue plants would be in the Corn Belt, most of them, where we have the corn stover. And they projected that the forest residue plants would be located in the southeast and in the northwest. And then finally, we have our switchgrass plants located down here in Oklahoma. Now, these are projections that the EPA made to try and determine what would be required to fulfill the mandates. The challenge for the biorefinery is to have an efficient system, one of the challenges, to have an efficient system to provide a flow of biomass throughout the year from the thousands of acres of either corn stover or a dedicated energy crop. And we might need a highly integrated, coordinated harvest system. And this harvest system, the most efficient system, may differ depending on the feedstock. Certainly differ between municipal solid waste and crop residues, but it would also differ between crop residues and perennial grass. The contracting system for crop residues could be made with farmers, whereas the perennial grass contracting system would probably involve landowners to a greater extent. So we get down to the bottom question is, what is a farmer to do? Well, I would suggest wait until a contract is offered and evaluate alternatives, which is what they always do. And in the case they have questions, I would expect them to contact their local and state cooperative extension personnel to get precise, up-to-date, and very good information. But prior to signing a contract and prior to investing in specialized equipment and prior to establishing a perennial grass, I would encourage farmers to consider the potential for biorefinery bankruptcy. And so they might consider whether there's some contract insurance in the event that the biorefinery doesn't fulfill its contract obligations. So what is a farmer to do? Relax and farm. The challenges that remain are, as we said earlier, we need an economically viable conversion system that will lead to a profitable business model. Energy is a commodity. The least cost policy incentives, in the absence of subsidies, carbon taxes, or mandates, it is still extremely difficult to compete with fossil fuels on cost. So to summarize, we use a great deal of energy, and we use a massive amount of crude oil. The Gulf oil spill leaked 6 hours worth. The corn ethanol that we produced last year gave us 9 days worth of energy equivalents relative to our crude oil use. We've had unfulfilled expectations. The drop-in fuels is where we have our hope, and we expect our farmers to relax and continue to farm. I'd like to acknowledge the support we've received over the years from the Oklahoma Agricultural Experiment Station, grants from the USDA, the Oklahoma Bioenergy Center, the Sun Grant Initiative, and my colleagues in the Bio-Based Products and Energy Center here at OSU. So thank you very much, John.
Oh, thank you very much for your valuable thoughts and observations on U.S. energy demand and the biofuel situation here in the U.S. We have had a few questions come in from the audience, so if you're willing, we'd put a couple of those to you. The first is kind of a general question, runs along the lines of, what is biomass-based biodiesel? Is it produced from canola or soybean oil?
Well, biodiesel can be produced from any number of vegetable oils, but currently the canola oil is too valuable to be used to produce biodiesel. And that same is most of the food grade oils are more valuable for food than they are for producing diesel.
Right. I think this question is actually directed at something we mentioned early on, though, is biomass based diesel.
Well, the
canola or soybeans or the oil seeds would be a biomass.
Okay. And so it's a matter of terminology. Just wanted to clarify. So thank you for that. In kind of a broader sense, then another question came in here is, in terms of the cellulosic system that you've outlined in your discussion, are the impacts of the trucks on the road been accounted for in terms of the cost in the equation? Obviously, could have a large impact on some of our infrastructure here in the country.
I don't know that any additional cost has been accounted for. Presumably, the trucks would pay the diesel fuel tax and the tax on the motor fuels that are used to support and upgrade the roads. We asked this question early on about whether or not we could transport this much biomass over our rural roads in Oklahoma, and the answer that I received from one of the persons was that, well, the rural roads have to be sufficient to support the oil well service trucks that typically travel through Oklahoma, and so if they can support those trucks, they could also support the biomass trucks. But certainly there would be an increase in traffic on some of these roads, and that traffic would have consequences.
Yep, no question. So one other general question, maybe it's a fair question, but I'm going to ask it to see what you think. Question is, do you think that the realities that you've pointed out here in your presentation have been represented in the political debate on the issue regarding biofuels and the trade-off between those and petroleum-based fuels or more traditional sources?
So the question is, well, I think it's good for us to understand that when agriculture got involved in ethanol, the primary objective was to address the excess capacity problem in U.S. agriculture. And so if you believe that that is the objective, and then you consider what the consequences have been, you could argue that it's been a very successful public policy, because we have certainly addressed the excess capacity problem in U.S. agriculture.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for those comments. We have several other questions, but I think we want to get to our next presenter before we take those. We'll save those for our general Q&A session. Hopefully we'll have time here at the end. I'd like to turn now to our next presenter, Dr. Cole Gustafson, whose presentation will address a number of different components here in terms of the application of some of these concepts. But a little more about Dr. Gustafson's background. His research responsibilities actually include development of financial management strategies for farms, ranches, agribusinesses, and agricultural lenders. He also evaluates pilot crop insurance and alternative risk management programs. And as a researcher, he has authored more than 30 peer-reviewed journal articles and obtained over $1 million of grant funding. In addition to serving as a faculty member, Dr. Gustafson has also served as a department chair and associate dean for research. Dr. Gustafson joins us today to present the economics of wheat, corn, stover collection, the Dakota Spirit Ag Energy. So, Dr. Gustafson, please proceed with your comments, and we'll look forward to visiting with you once you're finished.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this inaugural seminar, and I'd like to thank the AAEA and the Western Section for organizing it, as well as to all the people that are online participating in this event. I'm going to take just a couple minutes and provide an overview for a recent feasibility study that we've just completed for the Dakota Spirit Ag Energy Project. This project is involved in a number of phases. In the picture that's shown in the lower right-hand corner, in the center, the first complex you'll see is an existing Cargill malt plant, and to the right-hand side is a new combined heat power facility that Great River Energy has constructed that's just about on the verge of becoming operational. The combined heat power facility is designed to produce steam for the malt plant as well as to supply renewable electricity to the state of Minnesota. Now, what Dakota Spirit Ag Energy is considering is a next phase to this project and the construction of a wheat straw to biofuel plant that will be located just to the south or to the bottom of this picture in the grass area to the south. And the question that was posed to us is the collection of wheat straw for this plant a feasible activity. The project that is being proposed is actually going to rely upon Danish technology. They have a demonstration plant that's already up and running that takes these large square bales of wheat straw in Denmark and then processes them into ethanol using very similar equipment to a corn ethanol plant. One thing that's been fun in this project is we have actual operational data for cellulosic biofuel production. And in the plant in Denmark that is operating at the present, you can see the amount of straw that's entering the plant, and then the quantities of ethanol, biopellets, and animal feed that are produced, both in tons and in energy equivalents. And in my mind, when we look at it from energy, they're roughly one-third, one-third, one-third with respect to shares. The ethanol obviously will be sold for biofuel. The biopellets are going to be moved across the street, if you will, and mixed in with coal for the combined heat power facility. Essentially, this is lignin that's left over from the ethanol production process. Now, you also see at the bottom of this chart that animal feed is being produced as a co-product. This is not the dry animal feed, distillers grains, that we're accustomed to from corn ethanol plant. In these new cellulosic plants, this byproduct is actually going to be a liquid. It's going to be a molasses representing all of the C5 sugars that are unable to be processed into biofuel. So one adjustment that farmers are going to have to make in the future is to shift from their use of dry distillate grains into these molasses-type products that are going to be evolving from cellulosic firms in the future. Now, getting back to our feasibility study, the core questions that we were asked is how much wheat straw is available in the trade area surrounding Spiritwood. Are farmers willing to provide it, and what are the logistics involved of getting it from the farm field to the plant? the short answer in our study is it's already being done. We have another firm that's known as Prime Board, located near Wahpeton, North Dakota, that's actually already collecting wheat straw. You can see this piles from the 2010 harvest. Each pile is roughly 8 bales high, 13 bales wide, and when I move to my next slide, you can see they're about 100 bales deep. If you do the math, 8 by 13 by 100 times 4 piles, you'll see that there's roughly 40,000 bales of wheat straw accumulated for processing in the coming year. The project for our biofuel refinery is going to be 10 times this size. So that's where the challenge of the logistics arises. I should back up just 1 second. With respect to the farmers, the way this arrangement works is the farmer receives $10 to $15 for the wheat straw as it lays in their field, and then a private contractor is hired at approximately $35 per ton to bale, transport, and then deliver the straw to the Prime Board site. So total cost to Prime Board is roughly $50 per ton. Now, when we started looking at our Spiritwood project, the first thing that we noticed when we looked at the long-term baseline projections from USDA is that wheat acreage is forecast to decline. And obviously this is a concern. We are building a long-term wheat straw biorefinery. So we quickly engaged the project sponsors and encouraged them to begin considering the use of corn stovers in addition to wheat straw, both to diversify and secure the long-term feedstock supplies. They've actually done this and are now looking at modifying their process in Denmark to try to account for greater use of corn stovers. But the challenge is that each feedstock requires a unique enzyme. Well, as we get into our study, this is a GIS map that shows the location of straw surrounding the Spiritwood site. This is a 100-mile radius, which represents essentially the southeast quarter of North Dakota. There are three counties on the right from Minnesota and three counties to the south from South Dakota. So you can see it's quite an extensive network. The challenge that we face with Spiritwood in the center is one of density versus distance. The most dense areas of wheat straw production are located most distant from the Spiritwood site. So that obviously represents an economic issue. We have the same challenge with respect to corn. Corn is grown in the southeast corner of the state, at least the majority of it is. Again, it's most distant from the plant. When we made our final recommendations to the project sponsors, these were the optimal locations for substations where farmers would initially haul their stovers for transportation to the plant over the winter months. We were hoping for a little bit more overlap so the substations could be used for both wheat straw and corn stovers, but again, the economics and the production locations didn't allow this, again, representing an additional economic challenge to the project. The bottom line results from our study is that there are 1.2 million tons of bone dry stovers of wheat straw available within the region. I'm focusing on wheat straw first to illustrate what our summary conclusions were. It's available at 10% moisture, it's very dry, so we're not hauling a lot of water, and in addition, it'll keep well through the winter months. Our corn study, as you'll see, is moisture is a considerable challenge because it has to be harvested at less than 20% moisture, and that's a challenge in our northern climates in the fall to get it that dry, and that's really a threshold. We can't have any wetter material because molds develop and it destroys the enzymatic process in the plant. The plant wheat straw height in the field is roughly 35 inches tall. We have that information from our variety trials. And we had to know what the combine cutting height was. And that's a challenge. We had a number of challenges in our study because we don't have a lot of applied information available to answer questions that were being posed. How high do farmers cut their wheat? So I actually had to do a survey across the region, get out my tape measure, and the average height in the fields that I sampled was 7.6 inches. This is important because we need to know how much organic matter is removed and the volume of wheat straw that can be removed from the soil. I'll talk more about that later. And bottom line is the producers are willing to supply the straw, but they don't have enough labor or time to harvest, bale, or collect it. So in most cases, we're looking at custom operations, and there is adequate time to harvest as well. This is a detailed table. I know that it's difficult to read. It just starts with each county in the area on the left-hand side, and then as we move out to the right-hand columns, 25 miles, 50, 75, and 100, you can see how the availability of wheat straw increases. I believe there will be a copy of our PowerPoint slides being made available online, so you can look at these details later on after the conclusion of our seminar today. Another challenge that we had is trying to determine if farmers, if there's going to be enough time for a custom operator or for farmers to actually collect wheat straw. We have a very limited number of field days in North Dakota during the fall season. We raise a number of crops. So is there enough time by the time that the wheat harvest is completed until the next operation, field operation, to prepare the fields for next year's crop? I actually, again, had to do a survey each week. I drove across the area. I monitored each wheat field in the region to see how quickly it was tilled or had some other operation done. And you can see that at the end of week one, 20% of the fields were tilled, progressing up to 60% by the end of week three. It happened to rain during week four, so there wasn't any field activity. But these estimates, I guess, provide us assurance there was adequate time between field operations to go out and collect the wheat stovers. We conducted several focus groups. I'm just going to present a brief summary of the results here. The question is why producers don't collect more straw. It's not that they don't have a market. The most important reason, at least to the groups that we surveyed, was concerns about loss of fertility due to the removal of stovers. Again, stovers are very high in a number of nutrients. If they do decide to sell, no surprise here, given that we're economists, that price was an important factor. And we asked the producers what their reservation prices were. And this is a sample of the individual responses. You can see that they range on the low side from $15 per ton as it lays in the field, up to $50 per ton. So obviously there's quite a bit of range, and of course we as economists would expect that all these farmers have differing resource bases and the drover represents differing values to them. A little bit of surprise to us though is the farmers' reluctance to bale, store, or transport these crop stovers. North Dakota, in terms of background, has the lowest unemployment rate in the nation, averaging roughly 2 to 3%, and farmers have a great deal of difficult time, especially in the rural areas, attracting qualified labor, and given the time pressures of fall operations, just didn't feel they'd have the capacity to deliver straws to the biofuel plant. So the analysis we did relied on custom services for those operations. I have a couple closing slides here. What are the potential constraints to the project moving forward? Obviously, as Francis had alluded to, economics is one of the key drivers, but there are a couple additional ones. First, when we look at our analysis of available stovers within the region, we came up obviously with the mathematical number, 1.2 million tons, but really only half of that is available for processing. In our region, we have two types of combines. Those of you familiar with agriculture can know them as red versus green. One of them is a rotary combine, and with dry material processing through it, ends up being dust and very difficult to bale. So when we looked at actually what stovers are actually available, we only have 50% that's available for collection within a market area. A second question is who actually owns the stover? And we actually had to do some legal work to try to discern that. And it turns out that in most cases, the tenant is the one that has operational control. There's a little caveat, though. in that the tenant must leave the land in the same condition as prior to field operations. It's from the perspective of the landowner. So the landowner could raise a concern about the removal of the stover affecting long-term soil health and environmental well-being. So it isn't quite clear yet who has the final say with respect to sales of crop stovers. The final constraint involves NRCS policy. And this is the one that I think could possibly be the most challenging in the future. NRCS, if we contacted them to find out what guidance they would have for with respect to designing an optimal crop stover removal system, and they haven't formalized the policy yet, but their thinking is that they'd like to move to guidance that would essentially encourage producers to leave 2,500 to 3,000 pounds of organic matter left on the soil regardless of which crop is being produced. So in the case of our project with wheat, wheat has an average yield of about 40 bushels per acre in our area and leaves 100 pounds of organic matter at the end of the production season. So you do the math, 40 times 100 is 4,000 pounds is available to work with. You think that would be enough organic matter to enable some collection. The issue is one of crop rotations. In our region, wheat is commonly rotated with both corn and soybeans. And from NRCS's perspective, they're taking a longer-term view and looking at organic matter left at the end of the rotation. Since some crops, like soybeans, don't leave a lot of organic matter at the end of the cropping season, the other crops in the rotation, like wheat and corn, have to make up for that void. And when you work through all of the numbers, there really isn't any room to collect any stovers if we're going to be being maintained soil health as encouraged by NRCS. So again, this is just a formative policy, but I think it illustrates the conflict in our nation's policies with respect to environmental services and biofuel policy. This just isn't a North Dakota issue. I recently came across a table from a study in Iowa, and even at 200 bushels of corn, this is corn-soybean rotation, with 200 bushels of grain yield under chisel tile in rotation with soybeans, producers would only be able or encouraged to remove less than a ton. If you're less than 200 bushels per acre, they recommend no collection of stovers. It isn't until that we get to 300, 400 bushels of yield potential that stover collection looks like it's be an optimal policy. So with that, I'm going to close and turn to my final slide and see what questions are available.
Thank you, Dr. Gustin, for your insights on the wheat straw and corn stover and the potential as a biofuel feedstock. We have a number of questions that have come in, so we'll try to take these in the order we receive them. I guess the first one is thinking about deeded land and management. I know you talked about sort of public policy there and concerns, but how concerned should we be about soil tilth and organic matter losses in a farming system with some kind of continuous harvest of the straw or stover? I mean, have you done things to try to evaluate what it is that would be a reasonable level to take or the yield consequences and so on, economic consequences of doing that on a continuous basis?
Well, obviously there are individual producers that have been harvesting stovers for livestock use, primarily both feed and bedding, for years. And I think, you know, when you visit with them, there's an open question in terms of what some of the long-term impacts are. Economically, I think there's always going to be an additional cost that one has to consider, both with respect to the loss of the fertility, the additional investment in equipment to collect the stovers, and then the long-term impacts on soil health, not only for organic matter, but other environmental services for wildlife, water, and wind erosion. So all these are going to be factors. Obviously, we have some dimensions of government that are encouraging greater conservation, while others are trying to promote, you know, new additional production of renewable fuels. So I see a bit of a conflict here, and I don't think it's going to be the economists that are going to be resolving this question independently, but in interdisciplinary venues with other scientists.
Yeah, it's certainly a complex sort of situation, I would agree. So another question, wondering about your personal thoughts about how likely it is producers are to supply significant quantities of either straw or stover, given current markets, or maybe looking forward with even higher fuel prices, maybe in the range of $150 a barrel oil or more, how likely is it that folks are really going to provide this type of a supply of biomass that would be needed to be a significant contributor to the biofuels sector?
Well, certainly, you know, increasing product prices, as you mentioned, $150 oil, encourages additional development. I still think we face challenges, though, with respect to the sheer economics, with respect to the cost to the producer, the cost of transportation, cost to our highway infrastructure of these processes. I tend to be focusing my work on the development of sugar-based activities that are maybe a little more direct and alleviate some of the production challenges that cellulosic technologies are now facing. I also think we're going to see biorefineries in the future making greater use of residues that naturally exist, whether it's from a food processing plant or other opportunity. It ends up lessening a disposal problem as opposed to incurring additional cost for a new commodity. So I think there's many ways that the industry can still develop, and it's not clear, as Francis has indicated, which one is going to end up winning out.
Very good. Another question here for you, Cole. Directed at the producer level, and person's wondering just how accepting do we think producers might be to allowing the type of traffic in their fields that would be required to actually pull this type of system off. I mean, is $15 really enough to incentivize producers to participate, or does that number need to go higher? And if so, what might the magnitude need to be, do you think?
Yeah, and that's really a good question. It really is a challenge. You can see on my pictures right now, when we start looking at affordable transportation of biomass, it has to be done in high-dense bales. And those bales require large-scale machinery, heavy machinery, to be operated. Now, if we're looking at the question of biomass after a crop harvest, you know, those fields are going to be more challenging with respect to being wetter. Heavier equipment is just going to further problems of compaction. And producers are already concerned about compaction and impacts on future yields within the region. So again, I see this as being a challenge, and it's something that producers are going to have to work through in their own situation and determine what some of these externalities are.
Yep, certainly true. So thank you for your thoughts. We'll move now, I think, to a kind of more general Q&A session. We've got a number of questions coming in from the audience here. I'm pretty sure we're not going to be able to get to all of them, but those of you listening, please be assured that we will forward these to the presenters and give them a chance to possibly respond to those after the fact. But to get started, we have a question here. Maybe Dr. Eplin could take this one. Is in terms of an overarching kind of policy level question, do you think there's enough marginal land to grow a significant quantity of biomass to actually affect energy demand in the U.S. Through the production of biofuels?
Well, that's an excellent question. Some of you may be familiar, several years ago, a group released what they became known as the Billion Ton Study, and what they concluded, or they proposed or found, was that about 55 million acres of U.S. land that is currently either idle cropland or cropland pasture or very marginal cropland could be ceded to a dedicated perennial crop such as switchgrass. And so emission marginal, so it wouldn't produce a great deal. But they concluded that about a quarter of the energy content of what we import of crude oil could be offset by that by those 55 million acres, and also by using a judicious use of corn stover and wheat straw.
Okay. Dr. Gustafson, another question for you. It looks like a question about whether or not the estimate was used previously for water needed to produce a gallon of ethanol is something in the range of about 4 to 6 gallons per gallon of ethanol. Is that still a reasonable number to figure on these days?
The ethanol industry is making great strides with respect to development of new technologies and productivity. Their energy balance is increasing. Water use is now falling for the new plants. The new plants now are targeting roughly 3 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol. We're working on a project here for an advanced biofuel using energy beets where it's actually be about a gallon. You have 1 gallon of water required to produce 1 gallon of biofuel. That's achieved, though, because the energy beets coming in are high in water. So I think the technology continues to evolve, and we're going to continue to lower the burden with respect to resources needed to produce our renewable fuels in the future.
Okay, that's a significant change then, so thank you for that. Another member of the audience is wondering whether we might be better off to consider burning biomass for electrical power generation as opposed to converting it to biofuels. Do either of you have some insights on that?
That was actually our first study for the combined heat power facility. They were looking to use wheat straw or other stovers within the region to mix with coal to generate renewable electricity. We quickly found out that they were expensive to transport, as we're finding out in our other studies. But in addition, it's not very cost effective just to burn the product. What the industry is gravitating towards is to try to pull out some either high value fuels or even better, high value chemicals from the process and then burn the residual with other feedstocks to develop renewable electricity. So at the moment, it's not very cost-effective just to mix and burn unless there's a requirement or mandate in the state for renewable, a certain portion has to become from renewable sources.
Okay. So thank you for that. I think this question would be best directed to Dr. Eplins, wondering whether or not the nutrient and or soil conservation value of the corn stover or other crop residues is being fully accounted for in the equation when we start looking at growing biofuels for biofuel production, biomass, I guess, for biofuel production.
I think I'd pass that off to Cole. We don't have a lot of corn stover down here.
Okay. Cole?
Well, obviously, that's based on my comments. We're starting to look at that, but I think it becomes a formula, part of the formula, when we look at expansion of biofuel industry across our nation, is that we need to look at these additional impacts to our resource base and environment.
Okay, another kind of a general policy sort of question, wondering whether or not the Department of Energy or USDA is likely to start shifting research and development dollars in the near future toward addressing this kind of infrastructure problems that you all both have identified in this morning's presentation. Either of you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think the answer to that is that they have invested in, they have several projects ongoing and where they have funded projects not only in feedstock development, but also in feedstock harvest, in feedstock transportation, feedstock storage issues, and so they have funded projects to address the logistics of moving the material from the field to the biorefinery.
I would just add, John, that I think they have invested heavily in R&D, but there's a gap right now that exists between R&D and commercialization, and I think that is leading to quite a bit of public discussion about USDA lending programs, DOE lending programs, and some of the initial risk capital that needs to be available to foster greater development of these projects.
Yeah, and certainly you have mentioned some other gaps in your presentation this morning regarding the practicality of it, too, and whether or not it's really a reasonable kind of a thing for a producer to consider given other alternatives. Along that line, we have another question, and I don't know which one of you would be best to answer this particular one, but a person is wondering whether or not one of these energy crops, given the current markets and so on, would be a better rotational crop as compared to the traditional corn-soybean rotation versus wheat. And just kind of wondering what your thoughts might be on that.
Well, this is Cole. I'm again working on an energy beet project that looks like it's just going to have wonderful agronomic benefits for rotational crops in our area. Particularly, it's a crop that's going to work well in saline soils, which are becoming quite problematic. So I think there are some opportunities for enhanced rotational opportunities for some of these energy crops, but not all of them. There's some of them that have been mentioned that I don't think are going to be particularly well suited for this region. So I think it's going to be very much site-specific.
Okay. Another question here is kind of an overarching question maybe for Dr. Eplin is wondering what you think the outcome might be for ethanol use if there really was no blend wall, as you mentioned in your comments, and you know what the level of production might actually be if there weren't some of those regulatory hurdles or boundaries to influence a production decision.
Well, I'm not sure that I fully understand the question, and maybe we can try and get this clarified. But the mandate requires the retailers of the gasoline to use the ethanol, and there were no blend wall, and then that also the question would be, are we talking about no blend wall with a mandate or without a mandate? If you remove the wall, and in other words, the moving it to E15 means that we could increase the theoretical blend wall, what we've done, what EPA has done, by increasing the waiver to allow for the 2001 vehicles to use E15, has increased the theoretical blend wall to about 17 to 18 billion gallons. Now, that means that's if all of those automobiles used the E15 and had access to it. Probably the one question that we have is if we're going to go to the 15 plus the 16 or the 31 billion gallons of ethanol, then that means we would have to increase substantially the number of E85 vehicles. And it seems like there would be an opportunity for the companies that are in the business of producing corn ethanol to also get into the business of merchandising E85, and I'm not sure to what extent they've done that, but if they made that available, and it probably would be required to make that available if we're going to find a market for the 15 plus the 16 or the 31 billion gallons of ethanol. I don't know what the outcome would be if there were no blend wall. If there was no mandate to use the ethanol, and if ethanol is more costly than crude oil, then the ethanol use would probably decline. But if it is more economical, then it would be the demand for the product or the quantity used would increase.
Right. Okay, well, thank you for kind of helping us to better understand that situation a little better. I think one final question we'd like to address here is a question regarding the handling of some of these biomass products. This questioner points out that Prime Board Incorporated is a particle board manufacturer and is wondering whether or not either of you had gotten any insights or have any direct knowledge from their experience in handling wheat straw for that type of industrial process.
That was the company that I had spoke about initially in my presentation, where we had those large four piles of hay. We visited with several people that are knowledgeable of their operations. They provided some insights in terms of the strategic plan that they have for acquiring and moving feedstock. But again, it's not adaptable because of the scale of some of these other biorefineries are so much larger. So even though it might work in a micro sense, when we look at the volumes of materials, it takes a little bit different business model to accomplish that.
Okay. Well, thank you for your insights. We still have a number of questions, and we'll get those to you follow up here. But in order to close on a timely basis, we better move to our closing comments. Again, very much want to thank both of you for taking the opportunity to be with us and spending time with presenting your thoughts as well as your willingness to address the many questions we've received. I'm really confident that the audience participating today has really benefited from your insights. Another chance here to kind of plug your membership. If you folks listening in this today are not members of the AAEA or the Extension Section, we would really like to invite you to join by following one of the URLs on the screen. I know I've personally found the participation in the association as well as the Extension Section to be of great benefit to my career, and I know in talking with many of my colleagues across the country, they feel similarly. So I would encourage you to think about that. If you have any ideas or suggestions for future webinar topics that we might consider, we'd very much invite you to share those with us via the chat window, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to provide to us regarding today's webinar, we welcome those again by the chat window, or we'd encourage you to contact one of the members of the Extension Section leadership, which are listed on the AAEA website. Speaker slides for today's presentation will be made available on the Extension Section web pages at the UR listed on your screen, and as well as, I think it's been mentioned as we've gone along, but we plan to post a link for the recorded version of this webinar at that site as well as soon as we can get that prepared. So in closing, let me again extend thanks to both of today's speakers for their excellent presentation on the economics of biofuels. I very much want to thank also the Western Extension Committee's Ag and Uncertain Times team and Montana State University for making this webinar possible. We'd also very much like to thank all the participants in today's webinar. We sincerely hope that you find today's content of value in your work, and we hope to see you again on one of our upcoming programs. Until then, we offer you our sincere hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's agriculture. For the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association Extension Section, I'm John Hewlett.